communities in our country. In the words of Angela Davis, if they come for me in the morning, they will come for you at night. Standing together as people of conscience and demanding Mahmoud Khalil's freedom, it is a stand against fascism, and it is a stand for our collective right to free speech and protest. I'm Dave Zirin. This has been a WPFW editorial.
At 89.3 FM, this is member-supported WPFW, Washington.
And welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, April 15th, Tax Day. As Ben Franklin said, there are only two things that are certain in life, death and taxes. And today is tax day. I hope you're dealing with that okay. I'm sure others aren't. I'm Dave Rabin, joined by my co-host, Jonna Parker, later in the show. I'll speak with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, Benga Ajilore, about the serious threat to Medicaid and food assistance through SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, and we'll be joined by the executive director of FilmFest DC, the Washington, D.C. International Film Festival, which begins on April 24th and runs for 8 days. But first, our co-host, Jonna Parker, is going to speak with a candidate for the county executive for Prince George's County. Take it away, Parker.
Good morning. Yes, I am Jonna Parker, and we are on the Community Watch and Comment listeners. Call us right now at 202-588-0893. That is 202-588-0893. As today, we are continuing our discussion of a very important topic to many of our listeners in Prince George's County, the recent special primary elections in the county council for the county executive seat, vacated when the previous county executive, Angela Alsobrooks, moved to a U.S. Senate seat. Out of a very crowded field emerged our current state's attorney, Miss Aisha Braveboy, as the Democratic nominee, and Jonathan White as the Republican nominee. Today, we are joined by our state's attorney, Aisha Braveboy, and next week, we will have Jonathan White on the show as well. State's Attorney Braveboy, welcome to Community Watch and Comment. And again, callers, call us at 202-588-0893 to ask Ms. Braveboy, SAO Braveboy, a question. So let's jump right in. You have been in politics for years at this point, having been a delegate in the Maryland State House and now the county's state's attorney. Can you tell us your journey in relation to entering politics?
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Jonna. It's great to be with you and David and the WPFW family. You know, when I went to Howard University for law school, I had absolutely no interest in, number one, being a prosecutor, number two, being at the local government level. I thought, you know, I'd be at the federal level and then maybe go into the private sector. I was focused on telecom law at the time. So entering in politics was really a surprise to me. My father encouraged me to work on a campaign. And I said, okay, Dad, after he kind of, well, Caribbean parents, they kind of tell you or encourage you, but really they're telling you what to do. So I work on a campaign, and then the person won, Mr. Jack Johnson won, and I worked in his administration for about 3 years. I did policy work, and I also ran the real estate office for the county before venturing out and ultimately running for office myself. The reason why I ran for office actually was because I spent a lot of time in the evenings at a community meetings with homeowners associations and civic associations. So when you work for an executive, you have sort of a daytime job, and in the evening you're representing that executive. And so I would be the face in the community. And a lot of folks, especially in the area where I lived, got to know me, really liked me, and I was able to connect them with government services and resources, and ultimately, you know, got some you know, attention to some of the issues facing our community. So getting into public service was then pretty natural for me because I was already kind of serving the people. So it's been a great ride ever since.
That's so interesting. I'm gonna ask you some more questions, but I didn't know that you had worked in a previous kind of executive administration for policy, specifically around real estate and the civic associations, the HOAs. And I think that's so interesting because I feel like I know a lot about you, but I didn't even know that.
I was the liaison to the county council, if you can believe that.
Wow. Oh, that's a big role in itself.
It is a really big and very important role because, you know, those branches of government have to work effectively together in order to get things done. And during that period was we opened National Harbor, if you can remember. So I was responsible for making sure that bond financing package got approved by the council. That's the time when we got Wegmans and Woodmore Town Center became a thing during that time period. But again, it was because some of the legislative actions that were, the executive, you know, needed in order to make these projects work. And it was the very first time that Prince George's County achieved a AAA bond rating. So, you know, a lot of the work that we did to get our economy strong and to have projects that were bringing in revenue showed the bond market that, hey, you know, this is a great place to invest and that we were going to make good on our investments. And so, you know, So I really truly understand a lot about county government, how it works, the important work that we do with our council, and how important it is to have that strong relationship.
I love how you kind of alluded to the fact that a lot of these projects, even though they may be completed under one term, they actually start in other terms and other under other county executives. Their initiatives are began and pushed in those offices, and then they go on to be completed in other phases. So I really appreciate that. So let's talk a little bit more as we are waiting for some callers to come through at, again, 202-588-0893. Let's talk about your work. I mean, I love how you started with, you know, the beginning, but let's talk about like you as a delegate and then you also as a state's attorney, because I think those are the things that people more recently remember. So if you can kind of walk us through
your
work and accomplishments in those two spaces.
So as you know, when I was a state delegate, I was elected by my peers to be the chair of the Black Caucus. So I did a lot of work, not just for Prince George's, but really for the state of Maryland. A lot of work around equity, around ensuring that we had a justice system that was fair. And in fact, it was during my tenure as a delegate that I pushed for and was one of the strong voices to get rid of the death penalty here in the state of Maryland. So that was a huge accomplishment back then. We also decriminalized at that time small amounts of marijuana. Of course, now it has changed in terms of now we have recreational use of marijuana in Maryland that is legal. But at the time, you know, decriminalizing was a big step. In addition to that, giving those who were, returning to our community, returning citizens, the right to vote. I mean, that is something that was my very first bill I put in. Now, my version of the bill as a freshman didn't pass, but the issue was one that got taken up during my first year, and we were able to make some really good movements around that. I also became somewhat of a little bit of a maverick during that time because I was not one that always went with the flow of the Democratic Party, and I had my own mind, my own thoughts, and so I was always been an independent thinker, and so I worked, of course, with the party, but I worked with across party lines when I thought it was important on issues. So, you know, so when I left the legislature, I left because honestly, I love the legislature. It's great. But, you know, you're legislating, you're coming up with ideas, and then you're hoping that an executive will implement them. And I really wanted to be in a position where I could actually implement some of the ideas that I had. And so that's why I began to look at other options for me to continue to serve, but in a different way. And eventually I became, of course, state's attorney. for Prince George's County. And in that role, and in the current role I'm in now, we have been able to do a lot of great work to protect our residents. We've been able to drive down intimate partner homicides by over 40% by doing things like making strangulation a first degree felony offense, by developing a strangulation protocol, having really smart interventions at the local level to assist people who are dealing with violent situations. In addition to that, we have been able to really target gang crimes, and we have seen crime drop dramatically in some areas like Glen Arden, because we have been able to kind of go after those crews and those neighborhoods that have quote unquote beef for no reason for the most part, but they have this beef that leads to violence, shootings, death. And so we've seen that, diminish in many of these areas. And so while COVID, and COVID was of course a surprise to all of us, revealed some things about us as a society, some of the mental health concerns that we have, some of the housing insecurity and food insecurity that we have, and that social isolation that was felt and how that really impacted people, their behavior. We saw a lot. So we were able to work through that. You know, obviously around the country, we saw spikes in crime, but then we kind of worked through, and now we're seeing crime drop pretty dramatically, but we're working together, but understanding now that we're gonna need to have more community-based support systems, especially around mental health, to assist people who really need support, more support. So we've been able to do things like that. I, of course, am the first state's attorney to instruct my prosecutors not to seek cash bail as a condition of release, and that has significantly reduced the population of people who are in jail on very minor offenses who can be out in the community safely. In addition to that, that created a conviction and sentencing integrity unit. Sentencing integrity was the first, like I was the first prosecutor to do that, where we reviewed old sentences of individuals who had served a significant amount of time and had become different and new people and deserved the opportunity for a second chance. So we certainly have been very tough on violent offenders, but we have also been compassionate and thoughtful and made way for people who deserved a second chance.
A lot of different accomplishments that happened while you were on as a delegate in the state house and as the state's attorney. I didn't know that you were the chair of the Black Caucus. So that's just something else. It's like, oh, okay, wow, that's great to know. Thank you for just kind of explaining all those things. I think now the question is, okay, help us understand the run for county executive. You know, we hear about this a lot in Prince George's County that, you know, there's state's attorney and then there's running for county executive. Can you kind of talk about your decision to run for the county executive and why these two offices seem to be so interconnected in context to like why this is what we see consistently within Prince George's County?
Well, I can tell you as state's attorney, you see a lot. And what you mainly see is where institutions have not met the needs of people, whether that's the institution of the family, whether it's, you know, the faith institutions or government, right? Whether it's healthcare or social services or employment services, what we know, or education too. So what we know is that there are many services that are provided by government there to assist people, but sometimes people are not connected to those services. And so sometimes I find myself saying, if only this child stayed in school, they wouldn't be out here carjacking. If only, you know, this person had access to mental health treatment, they could have gone in a different direction. Or if social services were able to find and assist with providing a quality home, then maybe they wouldn't be out, you know, trying to steal from stores. There are things that we know that government is responsible for, but may not be providing in a way where people feel like they have true access. And so I think it's natural, quite frankly, for someone in my position who sees the wrong, the bad, the worst of the worst in terms of issues that go on to say, I want to make a change. I know if we could do this better, then we'll have better outcomes. And so that's why I decided to run.
Thank you for that conversation piece and that connection. I want to give our community comment and watch, our community watch and comment listeners, the opportunity to call in with any questions that you might have at 202-588-0893. Again, 202-588-0893 for the Democratic nominee for Prince George's County Executive, Aisha Braveboy. This is going, guys. We've got maybe another 10 minutes with our state's attorney. So if you guys have any questions, please call us now. But as we wait for any further questions, let me ask you this, yeah. SAO Brave Boy. If you were to win this seat, you would be coming into office at a very, what some perceive to be a very stressful time for the county, for the country. Where do you feel like our county is now? And what specific plans do you have for the direction of our county moving forward?
No, I think our county is in a challenging position, right? We're in, we're a stone's throw from the nation's capital, but the occupant of the White House has decided to try to take as many of our federal assets away as possible. I heard even yesterday that there's, you know, this thought that we need to basically close and dismantle NASA, which, you know, is in Greenbelt here in Prince George's County. We know that the FBI, which we won fair and square, we know that unfortunately, that relocation is in jeopardy. And then we know that we have, I think, over 60,000 federal workers, whether they are employed directly by the government or through federal contractors, that will be impacted by these DOGE downsizing, you know, initiatives. And so we are really at facing very challenging times. But I know that we are a resilient county, and I know that we have really smart, very capable people who I think can be repositioned either in state and local government or in the private sector. These will still be contributors to our community. We also know that a lot of these individuals are homeowners. So we are absolutely watching the markets. I know in certain communities, they're seeing more homes going on the market, which means people are insecure about their future finances. So what we have to do as government now is really proactively assist people in finding employment opportunities. And in addition to that, we have to open up, you know, the opportunities in county government to do business with the county, because we have, again, federal contractors who are absolutely providing critical services to some of the most sensitive agencies in federal government, but somehow those same companies cannot get in business here in Prince George's County, and I believe that is wrong. So what I plan to do as the next county executive, should the people of this great county elect me, is to really analyze the opportunities to build and grow wealth here in our county through our procurement process. Because again, we have very capable people here. So we're not talking about handing out opportunities to people who don't deserve it. We're talking about people who absolutely work at a very high level, some in SCIF buildings, some for, you know, defense contractors and things like that. So we are talking about companies that are absolutely highly qualified, where the residents are here in Prince George's County. Many of those businesses also are located in the county, but for some reason, they cannot get involved in contracts here in our county. And if we don't do it, we don't help our people, no one else will. That's what we've learned now through this administration. So I think that we have to turn inward and see how we can do a better job of ensuring that we are providing opportunities for our residents.
And also, can you talk a little bit about some of the issues that, you know, since we have a little bit of time here, some of the issues that have been brought up by residents while on the campaign trail, the conversations around, you know, development and local constituent voices in county development.
Okay, well, can I just talk about one thing that I hear everywhere?
Sure.
Trash. Yeah. They are sick of seeing trash on the streets. And guess what? So am I. Okay. And so we will have a huge initiative around cleaning up our community. Our roads should be as beautiful as the people who live here. And I absolutely think the people of Prince George's County are beautiful and they deserve to walk outside and see beautiful streets. So we will have an absolutely like robust initiative around cleaning up. Clearly, we're responsible as the county for certain streets. Our state government is also, but at the end of the day, the residents can also play a part in helping to make sure that we have beautiful communities. And that is not something that is like unique. Like we have done it before. When I was first here in county government, we had a livable communities initiative. So that is something we could absolutely do. And then also making sure that the community does have not only a voice in development, but gets what they deserve in terms of development. Because oftentimes, people are sold on the idea of a development with, you know, amenities, and then what they get is just housing. So that's a big issue.
Okay. I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, can you give me your name and where you're calling from?
Lee from Hyattsville.
Oh, okay. Lee from Hyattsville. Thank you so much for calling in. What's your question for?
For Candidate Brave Boy. So, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, perfect. So I guess this is an experience. I had a problem with my electrical, my box outside my house, and I had someone come and look at it. What impressed me was that it was this young guy who got his training maybe through high school and went through like an apprenticeship program. I guess I'm curious as to what kinds of, is that like, happening in Prince George's County, because he got his thing in Baltimore. So is that type of program happening in Prince George's County? Is it being promoted? Because every student is not going to go to college. Every high school graduate is not going to go to college. But are we talking more about these other areas where some of these young people can transition into and not come out of these programs with this high amount of debt where they can't function or can't live the kind of life that they want to live as young adults?
Thank you so much for your question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me tell you, we do have some programs, but not nearly enough. And I don't think that we promote those programs that we do have enough. And I have often said on the campaign trail, I pay more for people who probably have not gone to college in terms of services that I need than people who have gone to college, right? And so it is very important for us to understand that that service economy, that economy of labor is huge. It's necessary. And people who gain a skill, they can work for others or they can be self-employed. They are never going to be broke. I can tell you, an electrician, a plumber, a carpenter, there's always work for these individuals with these very highly sought after skill sets. So we do need to, I think, promote these programs more in our schools, connect more with our labor unions that have programs already and facilities here in Prince George's County. So we have some of the most state-of-the-art facilities for labor here in the county, and we need to make sure that our kids are exposed. So we do have some, but not nearly enough. And the caller was absolutely right. Like, we definitely need to make sure that our kids are, getting exposed to these opportunities. Whether they go to college or not, there's nothing wrong with having a skill. If you decide to go to college and you want to pursue higher education, that's great. But if you know you have a skill, no one can take that away from you, and you can always make money.
Thank you so much. We are running out of time. I wanted to give SAO Brave Boy to leave us with some final thoughts. What are your final thoughts that you would like to leave the county residents with as we close out this interview session?
Let me just say this. I would love to have the support of the people of Prince George's County. And I believe that I have worked hard to earn your support. And, we have a very critical election coming up on June 3rd. So we ask that people vote early. You can vote by turning in your vote by mail ballot, or you can vote, of course, in person during early vote or an election day, which again is June 3rd. But what I will say is I will always fight for you. Just yesterday, I was in D.C. fighting for Kilmar Garcia with his family, standing there asking for his return from El Salvador. No matter where he is in this world, he is a Prince Georgian. His children are here. His wife is here. He should never have been deported. And I will fight for you just as hard as I fight for the Garcia family. We need to ensure that every single Prince Georgian has access to the American dream, that we are giving our residents the best opportunity to be successful and to live quality lives. So I'm just asking for people to know that I have been a fighter always, and I will continue to fight for the residents here in Prince George's County.
Thank you so much. Again, my name is Jaina Parker, and I was joined by the state's attorney for Prince George's County, Aisha Braveboy, who is the Democratic nominee for this upcoming election cycle for the county executive. Next week, we'll be joined by Jonathan White, who is the Republican nominee for the Prince George's County executive role. Thank you so much for joining us, state's attorney Braveboy, and we look forward to seeing all the endeavors of you in the future.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
Wonderful. It's great hearing from the candidate for the executive, the county executive seat. Thank you so much, Janet, for that interview. And on with the show. Amidst all the political chaos emanating from Washington since Trump took over, you might have missed that House Republicans passed a budget blueprint last week that many analysts say paves the way to take Medicaid, health coverage, and SNAP food assistance away from millions of people. We're talking millions of people. The cuts will partially pay for huge tax giveaways for wealthy households and businesses. At the heart of the blueprint is an extension of the 2017 Trump tax cuts and plans to enact up to $1.5 trillion, that's with a T, in new tax breaks. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities asserts that with this budget framing, there is no way to cut $1.5 trillion in spending while protecting health coverage through Medicaid and food assistance through SNAP. And joining us to talk about this serious threat, this very, very serious threat, is the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities Chief Economist Benge Ajilore. Thank you so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you for having me.
It's really great having you. We welcome you, and we welcome callers 202-588-0893. We got a lot of ground to cover, but we want to get our callers in. If you're trying, this is Community Watch and Comment, and we want your comments. What exactly is Medicaid for the uninitiated? I think a lot of people don't understand the reach of Medicaid. It's really an important program that affects, what, 1 out of 5 Americans. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, so simply put, it's just a public insurance program to provide health coverage for low-income families and children. And so it covers a wide variety of people. And it's basically, if you think about it, as a floor to help people provide to get healthcare access. And that one, you know, thing I would like to add about that is that it's not just about healthcare access, but it's also about the viability of hospital and health centers. This is very big for rural places.
Yeah. And we're talking about 4 out of, I didn't realize this until I was preparing for the show, 1 out of 5 Americans are using Medicaid. 4 out of 10 children in our country are using Medicaid. I mean, it's a very, very extensive and important program.
It's an incredibly important program. Can you even think about, you know, 6 million seniors, 9 million people with disabilities? It covers a whole swath of people that need healthcare access.
Yeah. And what is SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps? If you could talk about SNAP for us.
So this is an important nutritional program that basically puts food on the table for millions of people. I think about that, you know, nearly 62% of SNAP recipients are families with children. and 37% are in households with older adults with people with disabilities.
Yeah, and SNAP is used by, what, like 1 out of 8 Americans and 1 out of 5 folks living in the District of Columbia.
Yeah, it's just a lot of people use these programs, and it's, and the other thing is, like, you know, this is a program at the Department of Agriculture, but it touches people all across the country. And you think about kids who need food in school, kids during the summer, there's, you know, summer programs that provide food and access for kids who are not able to afford food.
Yeah, very extremely important program. We're talking about food, folks. We're talking about, you know, people not going hungry. It's, you know, this is like a safety net that people have come to depend on, and it's under serious threat. And first Senate Republicans and then House Republicans last week passed resolutions that would extend Trump's 2017 tax cuts, largely for the wealthy. So no Democrats were involved in either chamber of Congress?
No, this the instructions were provided for budget reconciliation so that the Republicans would not need Democrat votes for this.
Right. I mean, this is totally a Republican venture, if I'm understanding correctly. And you assert that they can't make the tax cuts without serious Medicaid and SNAP cuts. Why have to make any cuts? Couldn't we cut from somewhere else other than the Medicaid and SNAP?
Well, you have to look at what are the biggest expenditures from the federal government. And if they don't cut Medicaid and SNAP, they're going to have to tackle Social Security, Medicare, other, say, non-defense spending. And so a lot of times it's a lot easier to cut Medicaid and SNAP because we've seen this over the last number of decades.
Right, because Social Security is the quote-unquote third rail that you can't touch. And another third rail is, you know, I need to do a whole program on this. We can't touch, God forbid, the Defense Department. I mean, you know, which used to be called the War Department until, what, after World War II. It's all about defending, right. You know. I mean, if you could just touch on that. I mean, it's extraordinary that the most vulnerable people in this country are the one exposed to extending Trump's tax cuts from 2017 and, what, making them permanent? And we, God forbid, we can't look at the Defense Department.
Right. And so one of the things that we have to also remember is that this is not just about the Medicaid and SNAP cuts and what the Republicans are doing. But if we think about the DOGE cuts, they're actually tackling Social Security, actually tackling the Department of Defense through our reductions in force, through some of the other executive actions like closing field offices, reducing staff, that lowers customer service. We see this at IRS. We see that at Health and Human Services, at the Department of Agriculture. So while they're not tackling it through the budget, they are tackling some of the stuff that's actually not even, you know, creating cost savings for the federal government. So they're using kind of end around policies to try to tackle some of those things.
I mean, and this is happening at the same time that they're cutting programs that would provide, what, food to food banks, food to schools. I mean, there's such a, it's a fire hose that you can barely keep track of it. And, you know, who's exposed if you're talking about cutting food to food banks and public schools? The same people that are exposed to potential cut to Medicaid and SNAP.
Exactly. This is all tackling low and moderate income working families. And so the program that you're talking about is a $1 billion program that provided food to food banks that help people during, you know, extreme times. And so in addition to Medicaid and SNAP, this is kind of like, you know, basically programs that are part of the safety net that are supposed to catch people. And they're basically cutting holes in the safety net all to pay for a lovely tax cut.
Yeah, I mean, it's really rather craven and goes against, you know, Trump running on a platform of supporting working people. These are the very people, you know, that are going to be cut under the this $1.5 trillion plan that the House and Senate Republicans are talking about. And we should state for the record that when you're talking about these cuts, you're not talking about just people of color. You're talking about all kinds of people, predominantly white people, and a lot of them are in Republican red states. I mean, isn't this kind of politically dangerous?
I mean, we have to see what happens in a year and a half, but right now it is tackling, you know, it's hitting everyone in their pocketbook all across the board. One of the things that we haven't talked about yet, but, you know, you think about what's happening with tariffs, and that's raising the cost of food and cost of clothing and cost of electronics all across the board. So you add that to what cutting spending for Medicaid and SNAP, you add that to the executive actions that are lowering customer service and access for people. And this is going to, you know, geographically disperse, that it's going to hit everybody all across the country.
Yep. And we're talking about what, close to $1 trillion, just, we're not even talking about SNAP, close to $1 trillion in Medicaid cuts over 10 years, right? What I've heard, figures like $880 billion. You know, a billion here and a billion there, and you're talking real money here.
Exactly. So $880 billion for Medicaid cuts, $230 billion for SNAP cuts. And these are floor. Like, they're saying that you don't want to cut anything less than that. So it actually can go up higher. It can go up to $1 trillion for Medicaid and things like that.
Yep. I mean, this is like really draconian and really serious. You know, we're talking about children here. We're talking about people, you know, with low incomes that are working, that need the support of these programs. I have more than one friend that have been, you know, affected by the federal layoffs, and they're going to Medicaid. And these are middle-class folks that need Medicaid and potentially need SNAP to support their families. I mean, it's extremely serious. I should say, I'm speaking with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities Chief Economist, Benga Ajilore. So great having you with us. And we would like to hear, we've got a few minutes left. If you want to chime in, callers, we'd love to hear from you. 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Love to hear from you. What would Medicaid and SNAP cuts actually look like? I mean, if you can give us a brief description of the actual cuts and their effects.
So some of the things that we're hearing about is one of them adding a work requirement to Medicaid. And one of the problems with that is that adding a work requirement doesn't make people work more. All it does is decrease their eligibility. And then booting people off of Medicaid, and same thing with SNAP. They're also, so Medicaid is a joint funded by the federal government and state governments, but state governments are the ones who implement the program. And so they're talking about capping federal funding on state, cost shifting onto the states. And one of the problems is that states have a balanced budget requirement, so that if they have to spend more revenues on SNAP, that cuts spending from other places. And so it's kind of shifting the onus onto the states from the federal government. Other things with SNAP, you either are going to cut, you know, funding for it, just, you know, do less, cap the funding, or you make the eligibility more stringent and basically kick people off. The more people you kick off, the less money you spend on SNAP. And so basically what it does is that the way they're doing the cuts is basically providing less support, less of a safety net for the people who most need it.
Yeah. I mean, it's really trying to undo everything that was generated starting, I guess you could say, back in the New Deal, back in the 30s. It's a paradigm change. I mean, we've got Trump doing a paradigm change with foreign policy, and it's happening right here domestically. And then you've got the whole tariff drama playing into this. You touched on that earlier. If you could talk about that, we're talking about a recession threat, an inflation threat, people losing jobs, if you could speak to that.
Yeah, and so the tariff scheme on top of everything else is just so chaotic and haphazard. What you have is that it's not just about the China and the tariffs there, which is, you know, really exorbitant tariff rate of 145%, but then you have tariff on our allies like Canada and Mexico. You have tariffs on steel and aluminum and auto imports. And then you add on top of that a 10% across the board, over 70 countries, a 10% tariff, which on its own is very high. And so if you take all those things together, we have the highest effective tariff rate since the 1930s. You talked about the New Deal. That's where we're going back to the 1930s, 1920s. And all that's going to do is raise prices for consumers, raise prices for businesses. It's going to have a really devastating impact for farmers because now you have these countries that retaliatory tariffs. And so now our export markets are being harmed. So you think about what's happening to the farmers and ranchers. Their input prices are going up because of tariffs and their export markets are being closed off. So that's going to have even more impact. And so you raise prices, that's going to, you know, there's concerns about inflation. You're also making it harder for people to afford food. And so that increases the risk for recession. And on top of that, if a recession, people are going to lose their jobs. What are the programs that they need? Medicaid and SNAP. And you're cutting those things too.
Right. And if we do fall into a recession, and some people are talking about more than recession, I think I heard yesterday on one of the Sunday morning talk shows, you know, we're looking at, you know, conceivably a depression. This is not from some left wing, you know, whatever. This is from the largest hedge fund founder in history. I mean, this is a money guy saying, you know, this could be more than just a recession. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm always hesitant to, you know, call for anything extreme, but I think the thing to think about is what is going to happen to the economy and do we have the supports necessary to help people guide through the economy? And then do we have an administration and a Congress that will step up and take the necessary actions to be able to combat this recession? And so given the budget resolution and the instructions that they have, we have to call that into question.
Yeah. So what is your alternative? What is the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities alternative to what this blueprint, which is, it's not a, you know, it's not actual law yet. We're talking about a resolution, continuing resolution. It's, I think you can call it a blueprint. What are you offering as an alternative for how Congress should go?
I mean, I think the biggest thing that we say is just don't pass this budget. Pass a budget that shores up the safety net, that it has more, brings in more revenue, not cuts more revenue, and just provide more opportunities for geographic prosperity.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extremely dangerous point. What's the schedule here? What Congress is out for 2 weeks now? What's your understanding of the schedule on them actually creating law on this? And Lord knows, you know, if Congress passes a bill that includes the Trump's 2017 tax cut, Trump's going to sign it. What's your understanding of the schedule here?
So my understanding is that they want to move pretty fast, that when they come back, that they want to be able to have start deliberations in early May and hopefully have something by the Memorial Day weekend. And so that's what their goal is, to really move fast and quickly on this, to have the president's signature before summer.
Yeah, I mean, it's we're talking a fast train here. And, you know, with so much else going on, it's, you know, it's kind of bizarre to think that this is happening without, you know, a lot of attention, because the it's a fire hose of initiatives. You're talking about attacks on Social Security. You know, big news yesterday that Harvard actually is standing up and is going to fight Trump's attempts to rein in universities. I mean, there's so much going on.
I mean, I've been following the tariff news, and that's been a 24/7, you know, ordeal where basically even on the weekends, you have to follow Twitter and Truth Social to see what actual policy is going to be. And so it's always changing. And so just like focusing solely on tariffs is a full-time job. And then you add in what's happening today's, you know, tax day, and you think about what's happening with IRS and the firings going on at IRS and a lack of customer service. And then you look at the budget. So there's so many things going on, so many things to follow, that it's very hard to keep up.
And it's not an accident. This is on purpose. This is, you know, if you go back and look at Project 2025, American Heritage Foundation, I mean, this is not just per chance. This is a calculated initiative that Trump is undertaking.
Yeah, it's one of the things where, you know, anytime in administration, those first 100 days, they're always trying to get as much done as possible before, you know, before the summer and before the, you know, next year is going to be an election year. So you always see this bombardment of policies coming through early on.
We're almost out of time. Your predictions, if you would, candidly, what do you think's going to happen? I mean, you've got these Republicans in the Congress. They seem to be totally subservient to whatever the master of the White House wants. What do you think's going to happen?
So I'm not in the business of making predictions. I'm just more of seeing what the actions are and seeing how to respond to them, because it's hard to figure out what, you know, at the beginning of this term, there's a lot of stuff that happened that I would not have been able to predict. So a lot of it is just follow the actions, follow the policies on a day by day, sometimes hour by hour basis, and then respond to that.
Yeah, we're so glad you were able to join us today. We're so glad that you're following these and other extraordinarily important issues. I've been joined by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities Chief Economist Bengan Jallouri. Thank you so much for all you're doing and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Really appreciate it. And on with our final guest. We need some relief here, I think, and I think we're going to be provided with that. I'm joined now by Film Fest DC, opens April 24th and runs for 8 days. We're joined now by its executive director, longtime director, I believe, Tony Giddens. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Yeah,
Thank you.
really appreciate it. It's great having you. What would you like to share with our audience today?
Well, one thing I'd like to say, to share is the incredible rich culture here in Washington, D.C., coupled with the gentleman you had on just previous to me, the economist, and how smart and bright and articulate he was about something that's not very easy to comprehend and to articulate. So I want to thank you for bringing that kind of information. And my work in the last few years has been in culture and the role that culture can play in a community to entertain it at minimum, but also to educate and to have people be exposed to cultures other than their own. So the organization that I've been working with the next last few years, the Washington, D.C. International Film Festival, we're getting ready to kick off our 39th festival here in Washington. And the festival runs from April 24th. So we just have about a week to go before we start to launch. And we run for show films for 8 days. So the festival will close on May 4th. We have 63 films from all over the world, 32 countries, shown with often with guests to discuss the films, and a wide variety of the types of films and the themes that we find in our global search for films every year. We're some of the films that I'd like to mention that our audience, your audience, might be interested in are a number of films that we have that are for by local filmmakers. In the last couple of years, I want to think it was a little after COVID, there had been this, we found that there were this influx, this sort of breaking forth of films by local filmmakers. We have a way of we ask for them and to people to submit. And I have to say that it's been very difficult in the last couple of years to distinguish out the ones we're going to show. They're all great to the ones that maybe need a little bit more attention by the filmmakers. And this year, we've put those films into a category called DC for Real. Again, these are films by local filmmakers. And so we have a film, this is a musical film from our music section. We have a film on Big Mama Thornton, who was a rock and roll blues kind of singer that most people don't know, but she sang all kinds of rock and roll songs before they became popular in other more, I want to say polished, but more commercial artists picked them up. And we have another film about the Dalai Lama's gift. I just want to give a sense of the variety of what we have. And this is about in 1981, the Dalai Lama went to Wisconsin and initiated thousands of Americans into this new type of meditation. And it talks about him going and the people preparing and the you get a sense of what a really interesting fellow the Dalai Lama is and people's response to them. And then we have another film in that set called Salad Days, which is about DC's punk history, punk music history. And it seems like I'm not a punk person myself, but I'm sure there are many of my friends who are. And DC was key in the development of punk music. There was a major label here, Discord. They had bands that came out of DC. And so we have all kinds of films. We have thrillers. We have a music section. We have a comedy, international comedy section. So we like to think that people who are interested in film would be interested in coming to our festival. Again, it's filmfestdc.org.
It's wonderful to hear this information. Great having you. Any other films you'd like to mention?
Yes. We have, this is just jumping around on our list of films that people can find on our website to give you an idea of the kinds of films that we have, the variety, and the interest that our Washington, D.C. audiences have found in our event every year. Last year, we attracted 11,000 people. And D.C. is a very special audience, smart, likes to know about things going on in the rest of the world. So we invite them and we invite all of your listeners to come by and check out our festival in a week or so.
It's great. Thank you so much for joining us. I've been joined by the Film Fest D.C.'s Executive Director, Tony Gittins. We really appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Good seeing you, David.
Great. Thanks so much. And that is going to do it for our show. Thanks to the amazing Mike for his engineering expertise. And coming up, the WPFW news headlines, followed by Don't Forget the Blues with Lady Murr, an extraordinary program. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dave Raven. Stay safe. And have a good week.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Everam and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Iverum and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at wpfwfm.org.
Code Pink Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your Jazz and Justice station.
Greetings, family. This Wednesday, April 16th, friends, neighbors, and comrades from all across the Washington area will assemble at Metropolitan AME Church for a D.C. Emancipation Day speakout to strategize, organize, and mobilize from 5:30 until 9 p.m. The event, Standing Together to Fight the Power, presented by the Metropolitan Washington Council, AFL-CIO, and the Federal Unionist Network, together with Harriet's Wildest Dreams, Free DC, The Washington Informer, and WPFW, will center how the community can protect DC home rule, save federal jobs and services, and support the city's most vulnerable.